But if you close your eyes.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning in. You're listening to This Week Again. I'm your host, Suzanne Posel. We're going to start off this show with what the fuck is going on college campuses. Move on to what new abominations the Supreme Court is considering making states' rights, and follow all of that up with some of the hilarious developments coming out of the New York hush money trial. Let's begin, shall we? So when Gen Z said this whole Israel killing Palestinians thing needs to stop, and fuck no with funding a genocide or continuing to arm a genocidal jackass, turns out they were serious. In fact, all across the liberal, woke indoctrination stations, as the tinfoiled affectionately refer to college campuses, Gen Z has been protesting America's continued involvement in the systematic extinction of an entire group of people. From marches to encampments, Gen Z is not at all shy about showing their disapproval of how the elderly are running this country. So it may come as no surprise to any member of Gen X that Gen Z's resistance to authority was met with impotent rage.
Columbia University's president asked the NYPD to break up a tent encampment.
150 protesters were arrested at NYU in a demonstration. The university says it asked the police to intervene.
Chaos on the campus of USC as pro-Palestinian protesters clash with school security and police. LA police officers in riot gear move in, and there are a number of confrontations as the police force encircles the center of campus.
Officers were sent in at the request of the university and under the direction of Governor Greg Abbott.
Abbott posted a social media quote, "The protesters belong in jail.
Send in the National Guard and wake these kids up."
Wow. Hot Wheels McGee governing Texas seems mighty upset that the woke liberals at those edumacation places are standing up for basic human rights. So much so, he's executive ordering college campuses to write out free speech from their policies and punish pro-Palestinian protesters as anti-Semitics, which seems like a complete 180 from, I don't know, just 6 years ago when free speech crusader General Abbott said this about college campuses and their rights, the rights of students to speak their minds. Roll tape.
Governor Greg Abbott says a brand new law in Texas will protect First Amendment rights. It will ensure that outdoor areas of college campuses are deemed public forums. It creates disciplinary sanctions for students who interfere with free speech activities on campus. So colleges have now until December 1st to submit reports to the state about how they plan to protect free speech rights on campus. They'll have to adopt new policies by next August.
Some colleges are banning free speech on college campuses. Well, no more, because I'm about to sign a law that protects free speech on college campuses in Texas. Shouldn't have to do it. First Amendment guarantees it. Now it's law in Texas.
Hey, Greg, is that you? Because past you wouldn't even recognize the free speech hall monitor you've become. Sounds like you've been hanging out with Get Off My Lawn Johnson, who took some of the most impotent of Republicans on Capitol Hill on a field trip to Columbia University so he could survey students exercising their free speech in real time. And here's what the tiniest Speaker of the House had to say.
The cherished traditions of this university are being overtaken right now by radical and extreme ideologies. And shamefully, some professors and faculty have joined the mob. As Columbia has allowed these lawless agitators and radicals to take over, the virus of anti-Semitism is spread across other campuses. By some counts, as many as 200 universities have a similar form of protest right now. Anti-Israel encampments are popping up at universities all across this country. Sadly, Columbia's administrators have chosen to let the threats, the fear, and the intimidation of the mob rule to overtake American principles like free speech. They have co-opted First Amendment arguments to elevate the voices of anti-Semitism. I am here today joining my colleagues and calling on President Shafiq to resign if she cannot immediately bring order to this chaos. As Speaker of the House, I am committing today that the Congress will not be silent. Go back to class and stop the nonsense. Stop wasting your parents' money. Enjoy your free speech.
Oh, I assure you, small sir, they are. And just for educational purposes, being pro-Palestinian isn't anti-Semitic, because lots of Jews think that corrupt minister running Israel right now is committing genocide under the cover of Hamas, so he can build a port of commerce right where the Gaza Strip just so happens to be. Jews in America, Jews in other countries, in fact, Jews in Israel are protesting Netanyahu's attack on the Palestinian people right the fuck now. But tell me again how college students protesting the U.S. involvement and funding of the extinction of a group of people over waterfront property is anti-Semitic. In fact, where in the bullshit did this goy from Capitol Hill get this moronic idea anyway?
What's happening on America's college campuses is horrific. Anti-Semitic mobs have taken over leading universities. This is reminiscent of what happened in German universities in the 1930s. It has to be stopped. It has to be condemned, and condemned unequivocally. But that's not what happened. The response of several university presidents was shameful.
Oh, from the Nutter himself. The guy who thought killing Palestinian women and children would be okay as long as he screamed Hamas before the soldiers pulled the trigger. Because according to the Israeli-Palestinian killer general, genocide is justified as long as it's self-defense. Except it isn't, and we know that. Israelis protesting Netanyahu's government in Israel know that. The students on college campuses abso-fucking-lutely know that. Hence why these protests are being framed as anti-Semitic. Because Holy Land forbid, more people know Jewish faculty and students were hanging out together with the protesters celebrating Pesach in the encampments and aren't afraid to say in front of a camera that prime disappointment running that Israeli state does not speak for all Jews.
On Passover, it's important to stand up for oppressed people everywhere, whether they're Jewish or not.
I am Jewish, and to me, Passover symbolizes perseverance and resilience. We have seen the university take countless measures to try to suppress our student activism, and here is us persevering through that.
I had seen so many statements online about how Jews weren't safe, about how Columbia had turned into a hotbed of anti-Semitism. Each of those statements further galvanized me to use my voice and my privilege as a Jewish person to come here and have a Seder with all of these lovely people.
I'm part of a really proud legacy of progressive Jewish activists who have participated in things like the civil rights movement or the anti-apartheid movement in the 80s, where it's so important to us to transcend the barriers of race, class, ethnicity, religion. And that's what's happening here today. And there's a lot of joy here, I think, really for the first time on campus in months.
There are also many non-Jewish students who joined the Seder, and we're a little bit hesitant about whether they should eat matzah or not. We told them it was okay, you can try some matzah. It was really a beautiful thing to see in the middle of the pro-Palestinian encampment.
Oh no! It's Jews recognizing that as a people who have been genocided, they can't just sit back while genocide is happening to someone else. That doesn't fit the anti-Semitism narrative the Israeli nutbag and the smallest speaker to ever have spoken for the House are trying to push right now to justify police brutality and quashing free speech. Because while all of this is giving Kent State vibes, it's also screaming, those who cannot remember the past are doomed to repeat it. And that may be your dementia showing, but either way, this is not going to end well if history has anything to say about it. Meanwhile, in Washington, D.C., the bogus SCOTUS is up to their usual shenanigans with some old bullshit the states concocted that apparently would be better served by the Supreme Jester's one-of-a-kind wisdom. And by wisdom, I mean thanks to the clowns of the highest court of our land. States like Idaho decided a woman's life should be the only thing stopping a fetus from being born. Now, when I say a woman's life, what Idaho means is that she has to be literally about to die, then go ahead and do what you gotta do. But remember, doctors face a minimum of 2 years in prison if some DA disagrees with whether or not that mother was actually going to die. So the Biden administration sued Idaho for violating IMALTA, the act that says ER doctors have to provide stabilizing care regardless of the health insurance status of the patient. And that means if an abortion or pregnancy termination is going to save mom, then get to aborting. But Idaho Republicans said, fuck Biden and mother mortality rates. So now the Supreme Intelligence is arguing over how many organs a woman can or has to lose before her pregnancy is threatening her life.
A divided Supreme Court now considering an abortion access case from Idaho that will reverberate from coast to coast. At issue, does a federal law mandating emergency care for those in need mean hospitals must provide abortion access if a woman's health is at risk?
The court's liberal justices vigorously argued that federal law requires all states that receive Medicare funds at their hospitals allow access to abortion in emergency situations when women's health is at risk.
The Emergency Medicine Treatment and Labor Act says that the entire person needs to be treated if their health or fertility, life is at risk, all of those things, anything that's running a risk of harming that person should be evaluated and treated right away.
The attorney general says the federal government shouldn't get to dictate state laws on abortion.
The U.S. Supreme Court needs to make it clear that when they decided on Dobbs that they meant it, that it's up to the states to decide whether they can have life-affirming legislation or not.
Well, terrifying Idaho Attorney General. I bet you're into states' rights, aren't you? Because states know whether or not women should be allowed to live, right? You know, sounds to me like bogus SCOTUS knew what they were doing when they said abortion rights, give those to the states. They'll know exactly what to do with them, said the assholes who failed high school history. And for those of you in the back, the reason why we had to have Reconstruction in the antebellum South after the Civil War was because states didn't always do the right thing. Hence why Idaho said the person who houses, feeds, and provides genetic material to the fetus isn't as important as the fetus itself. Because disregarding the life of a host while focusing on the parasite makes all the fucking sense, right? So, about that Idaho exception for the life of the mother, here's SCOTUS Jester Alito arguing that the life of an unborn child supersedes the life of the mother in any life-threatening situation.
One potentially very important phrase in EMTALA has hardly been mentioned. Maybe it hasn't even been mentioned at all, and that is EMTALA's reference to the woman's quote-unquote unborn child. Isn't that an odd phrase to put in a statute that imposes a mandate to perform abortions? Have you ever seen an abortion statute that uses the phrase unborn child? Doesn't that tell us something?
It tells us that Congress wanted to expand the protection for pregnant women so that they could get the same duties to screen and stabilize when they have a condition that's threatening the health and well-being of the unborn child. But what it doesn't suggest is that Congress simultaneously displaced the independent pre-existing obligation to treat a woman who herself is facing grave life and health consequences. Well,
so we have this phrase emergency medical condition in that provision, and then under E1, the term emergency medical condition is defined to include a condition that places the health of the woman's unborn child in serious jeopardy. So in that situation, the hospital must stabilize the threat to the unborn child. And it seems that the plain meaning is that the hospital must try to eliminate any immediate threat to the child. But performing an abortion is antithetical to that duty.
And what you just heard, my friends, is the origin story of how Jester Alito became the mascot for why judges should never make medical decisions for anyone, especially women. Because this 74-year-old father of two doesn't know the first fucking thing about pregnancy or how it is that the mother's womb, located inside the mother's body, you know, that houses the fetus until it's developed enough to exist on its own. So what the fuck do you think will happen to a non-viable fetus when the mother dies of sepsis or bleeds out? Because the doctors in Idaho are more concerned about how much prison time they're going to serve if they save her life. I'll help you out. The child dies. The unborn child dies. The fetus dies. They can't live outside the mother's womb. They die. So why in the fuck would you consider the life of a non-viable fetus more important than the person who is making the unborn child? Because that line of thinking got us into the potato head debacle we're in now, thanks to Idaho doctors having to decide between their jobs and their freedom or saving a life. Cue Justice Alina Kagan.
For example, I read recently that the hospital that has the greatest emergency room services in Idaho has, just in the few months that this has been in place, had to airlift 6 pregnant women to neighboring states, whereas in the prior year, they did 1 the entire year. Why is this happening?
Their livelihood is on the line, their medical license, their ability to practice medicine, their freedom if they have to go to jail and serve one of these minimum 2-year sentences of imprisonment, and they simply cannot provide the care, even consistent with their subjective medical judgment, because as a matter of medical reality, for many of these conditions, it's not yet putting a woman at the brink of death or necessary to prevent her death, yet they know that the standard of care is to provide her with termination, because she is just going to get worse and worse and worse if they wait it out. Tragically, in many of these cases, the pregnancy is lost. So in that situation, what Idaho is doing is waiting for women to wait and deteriorate and suffer the lifelong health consequences with no possible upside for the fetus.
Ugh, you know, I hate to harp on this, but seriously, what the fuck was so wrong with a middle-aged woman who wears a pantsuit that we had to elect Don Snorleone and he would put Karen, a beer connoisseur and a Nepo baby, onto the highest court of the land so we would end up right the fuck here in the middle of The Handmaid's Tale? And by the way, the reason states shouldn't have the right to decide what a woman does with her body is the same reason why we took some states' rights away when they legalized doing whatever they wanted to African bodies. So now that not every doctor can say with medical certainty that their pregnant patient is going to absolutely die when they come into the ER with a pregnancy-related issue, we're going to send her home to develop sepsis, bleed out, or just until she's banging down death's door before we try to save her life, because every sperm is sacred. Oh, and while we're on the subject of fucked up shit we have to deal with because elections have consequences, did you know that the question of whether or not a U.S. president should have absolute immunity is currently being debated by the bogus SCOTUS? Roll tape.
If the president decides that his rival is a corrupt person and he orders the military or orders someone to assassinate him, is that within his official acts that for which he can get immunity?
It would depend on the hypothetical, but we can see that could well be an official act.
How about if a president orders the military to stage a coup?
I think it would depend.
That's immune.
I think it would depend on the circumstances, whether it was an official act. If it were an official act.
If a president sells nuclear secrets to a foreign adversary, is that immune?
Well, I don't know in the hypothetical whether or not that would be an official act.
And just like that, America began its ragged and butt-burning decline into dictatorship. Because what Schindler's ambulance chaser was arguing, like, it made sense in a democratic republic that a president can kill his political rival, sell classified documents to foreign countries, and use the most decked out military in the entire world against its own citizens, and shouldn't be held accountable for any of that because he was president at the time. And there, my friends, is the fucking problem. This trash panda on his head wearing crop dusting, depends should have been changed 5 hours ago smelling, whiny little bitch already tried a coup all over the U.S. Capitol back on January 6th. And since then, he's been rummaging through our most secret of secrets while rage-truthing at 3 a.m. from his toilet, selling that information to the douchebaggiest of Middle Eastern dictators and crying outside courtrooms because he got caught trying to rig an election.
I was at the courthouse today in Manhattan for opening statements for this first criminal trial of the former president. I can report firsthand that the courtroom smells like old soup and stale breath.
The prosecution arguing that Trump's alleged scheme to keep an adult film actress quiet is election interference, pure and simple in those words.
Trump defense lawyer Todd Blanche told the jury that the former president, though, did not violate the law.
Trump craned his neck to eye prospective jurors and flashed a tight-lipped smile.
Leaning to the left, a little bit quiet, his arms crossed as well.
Hunched over with his elbows on the desk.
Looked through papers and periodically whispered to his attorneys.
Fidgeted and leaned back, the scowl fixed to his face while he sat squinting.
He was actually biting his lip during today's proceedings.
His lips pursed in that characteristic Trump way.
Oh, too bad for Slumpy Trump. He had to sit in a not-so-very-temperature-controlled courtroom in New York for just a few hours, 4 days a week. Ugh. Apparently, it's too cold in there, and Eric's dad had to miss his wife Melania's birthday because he had to show up to court, you know, to talk about how he cheated on his wife and committed election interference. But hey, karma's a hell of a girl, ain't she? So for those of you who have been living under a rock, apparently the Dawn of Eternal Stench and a dick named Pecker hatched a hair plug scheme to manipulate the press coverage of the 2016 presidential election.
David Pecker, he's the former CEO of American Media Incorporated, which is the parent company of the National Enquirer. Pecker told Trump and Cohen he would be their, quote, eyes and ears on stories that could be damaging to Trump.
And he also described a practice where he would, quote, embellish stories that Michael Cohen sent over to him about Trump's competition. Pecker said he told them if he heard anything negative, he would notify Cohen right away. And then he would be able to have those stories killed.
To find negative stories about Trump that hadn't been published yet, and then to pay the sources of the stories to make them shut up and not tell anybody about those stories before the election.
He shows that these payments that the jurors will hear more about, payments by Michael Cohen and payments by his parent, by David Pecker's parent company, American Media, were made in order to try and silence unfavorable stories about the president for the purpose of getting him elected.
Wow, talk about fake news. Folks, that catch and kill scheme wasn't even the end of it. Girth Vader and his favorite Pecker worked hard to make up bullshit about his opponents in the 2016 presidential race. That story about Ted Cruz's father and JFK's assassination? Yeah, made up by Pecker and Jabba the Gut. Remember all the headlines about Hillary Clinton and her failing health and pending prison sentence and her pension for drinking baby blood in the basement of a pizza parlor. All bullshit pulled out of the puckering brain holes of Pecker and the lumbering lardass. Not that this is a shock in any way, but I do have to say, this hush money trial is just getting started, and I can't wait for Stormy Daniels to take the stand. And that's all I have to say about that. New episodes of This Week Again air every Sunday. And don't forget, Sundays at 6 p.m. Ohio time, you can re-listen to this very show on Crowtown Radio. But if that's not enough, you can catch me once a week on Facepalm America, where me and host Beowulf Rocklin make fun of the news in real time on a recorded podcast. You can follow This Week Again on social media wherever you can find us. And we're always available for your listening pleasure on Spotify, iHeartRadio, Audible, Amazon, wherever you listen to podcasts. And thank you so much for listening to this show. Ta-der for now.